Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And today, I'm so glad to introduce a very special guest, Dr. Ariel Cooper. Hello, Ari.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And in interest of full disclosure, you are my daughter-in-law and agreed to be on our show. But let me tell the audience a little bit more about you. Dr. Cooper is a small animal general practice veterinarian. She's a graduate of Washington State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, and she's practiced in Mesa, Arizona for the past decade. Her professional interests include soft tissue surgery, dentistry, and internal medicine. Outside of work, she enjoys traveling, going to the theater, and spending time with her family and friends, especially her husband, Josh, and their two dogs and three cats. You're still at three, right? Three cats?
Yeah, we're at three. We dropped to two briefly, but we're back to three.
Excellent. So one of the things we love talking about this show is how people pick their careers, because a lot of my patients are teenagers and young adults, and they listen to these shows. So can you tell us why you picked veterinary medicine, how you came about to pick that career?
Absolutely. So I'm probably on the more rare end of the spectrum of someone who picked their career pretty young and actually kind of stuck to that. So I had probably been saying since about the age of 9 or 10 that I wanted to be a veterinarian. And as best as I remember, that kind of came about from, I always loved animals, always had a connection with them. We always had pets when I was young and growing up. And I was always, really interested in the sciences as well. And I believe it was either fourth or fifth grade we had to do a research paper on a career. And kind of look into, what schooling and what everything involved was to pursue that career. And I did that paper on being a veterinarian, including, what the, schools were and everything. And pretty much since that time, I always said I'm going to be a veterinarian, and that is where we are.
Amazing. And you're right. Many kids have dreams and they change as they get older, but you stuck to it. So, you went into college knowing you wanted to be a veterinarian. How hard was it to get into vet school?
I would say, kind of looking back at the time, it felt like obviously the most important thing in the world, and the statistics and everything were pretty staggering and discouraging, in that, they always tell you veterinary school is harder to get into than medical school for, whatever reasons, including just applicants per seat. I will say I think I had the benefit of knowing going into my undergraduate education that is what I wanted to do, so I kind of had my eye on the ball. I had really, really great advisors in my academic program kind of telling me, here's what you need to do. So, even though it felt like a real long shot at the time, I did get in on my first round of applications, and I applied to four schools and got into two of them. So it was, at that point felt like, okay, this is really happening.
What advice would you give others, students who are interested in veterinary medicine? What should they do to increase their chances of getting in?
So I would say first and foremost, you know, it's one of those things where, it can look like a really appealing career. Obviously, there's pros and cons to everything. So I would say if you get a chance to, see if you can just, shadow or kind of get a little bit more of an inside look at to kind of what a day in the life looks like, see if that really is something you see yourself doing and have a passion for, because I think without a passion for it, it's going to be a real challenge to get through those many years of, education and, a pretty rigorous, doctoral program. So I think that, make sure you really see yourself, having a passion for that. And once you do, it's obviously some of it's going to be about GPA. And I think the big emphasis is on the sciences and the science GPA, especially. But the other bit is going to be practical hours and just getting as much time around animals and veterinary medicine as you feasibly can. That really makes a difference.
What kind of exposure did you have to animals before you went to vet school?
Yeah, I started off around the age of 13. But actually, I kind of started it off as a project for my bat mitzvah, where I was fundraising and donating supplies to the local animal shelter. And through that, I became what they called a junior volunteer, so someone under the age of 18. But I, through eighth grade and all of high school, every single Saturday, I was spending volunteering with the animal shelter at their adoption center, which at that age was basically like, cleaning up kennels and providing enrichment to the dogs and cats and just kind of, I would answer questions that people have that were, visiting and trying to decide who they wanted to adopt. So that was the bulk really of my animal hours before going to college. And then once I entered college, I got a summer job basically as a veterinary assistant, where I was really then exposed to a lot more of what the day-to-day general practice looks like. So once I applied to vet school, I had many, many, hours of time that I could note for animal interaction.
And how many years is vet school for?
It is four, although there are a couple newer kind of accelerated. Most recently, the University of Arizona, which is in the state I live in, has a three-year accelerated program. So basically they go year-round instead of having, summers off in between the earlier years of the program. They go year-round for 3 years. But most of the traditional vet schools are a four-year program.
So, as you know, I went to medical school, and in medical school we have to focus on the human, and yet you have to focus on different animals. How difficult is it to learn the physiology and the anatomy of different animals?
Yeah, it gets a little more complicated when you start throwing in, obviously multiple different species. In vet school, they put an emphasis on what they call the big six species. So that's kind of the ones that are the major players that most of us are going to work with. So that's dogs and cats, horses, pigs, cows, and sheep. It was definitely a little more challenging when it came to, there was always those few questions on the, national board exams about turkeys or chickens or, bunny rabbits, but, they, a lot of times, surprisingly, a lot of the anatomy and physiology is pretty similar. I had one professor who always liked to say, well, mammals are mammals. So, a lot of traits carry over amongst at least mammals as a species.
But then did you study birds and reptiles too?
You could. I'll be honest. I didn't pursue that. A lot of what's interesting with veterinary medicine is if you have a special interest in things like exotics or zoo animal or just kind of anything outside of those big six species, it's a lot of kind of, you know, self-pursuit of those. I mean, they have the option there for sure. You know, we had an exotics program, but it's not part of the required curriculum, so it's kind of, you know, pursue your own interests, and there's lots of clubs, there's lots of, you know, opportunity to set up, you know, various things during your clinical year, but personally, you know, I got a little bit of it, obviously, you know, we had a little bit, you know, in lectures about it, but not a ton of hands-on experience.
Did you take a genetics course in vet school?
Yeah, genetics is a prerequisite class as far as undergrad. So we had genetics in there, and then we took definitely, you know, embryology and other, you know, genetics related classes in our curriculum, you know, prior to the clinical stuff.
Did they speak about cross species genetics, similarities and differences?
They do, yeah, and especially, you know, what I probably retained the best just because of, you know, personal interest is, you know, especially the differences that can exist between, you know, dogs and cats, because that's what I kind of knew that I was going to be mostly dealing with in my day-to-day, and there are some pretty interesting, you know, differences between dogs and cats that, you know, I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily think of, but, you know, even, you know, cross species of, you know, we talk a little bit about evolutional type things and, you know, selective breeding and all of those aspects as well.
Interesting. I became interested in animal genetics through my work in cystic fibrosis, believe it or not.
Sure.
Because when they studied the cystic fibrosis gene, cystic fibrosis is a lung disease that causes thick and mucus throughout the body, and causes early death without therapy. So we knew what the cystic fibrosis gene was, and I'll just go a little bit into genetics here because it's really interesting. So you have the exons and the introns. Exons are the active part of the gene, and introns are part of the gene that's inactive and thought to be sort of junk DNA by some people. But when they studied the cystic fibrosis genes throughout different animals, I think down to a mouse, through human, they found that certain regions of the genes were conserved throughout species, including introns, which means they must be doing something important. Did you guys talk
sure.
about that at all?
You know, it's been a minute, but it, you know, all of what you're saying is definitely, you know, tinkling some bells. And you know, it makes sense to me. I can think of, you know, examples in, you know, canine species that I'd have to look and see if there's any, you know, actual similarity. But, you know, we have, you know, an example is that in Shar Pei dogs, that is a species or a breed, I should say, that is known to overproduce mucin. And so they can have a lot of issues and they basically have a version of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome in people where they have, you know, connective tissue that is, you know, abnormal. So it is very interesting to see that, you know, some of these things are conserved across multiple species.
Yeah. So another thing I faced in medical school, I wonder if you faced in vet school, is ethical issues. Did you talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect in vet school?
So in veterinary school, at least in my program, we had a class on ethics starting year one. First year, first semester, I remember we did have an ethics class. And, you know, a lot of it, you know, in animals, probably the biggest example that we run into of a kind of ethical question is the fact that, you know, humane euthanasia is a fairly common component of veterinary medicine, which it obviously, you know, isn't in the human medicine world. So there, you know, become a lot of ethical questions about, you know, things like what we call convenience euthanasias, where, you know, it's more for the benefit of the, you know, the human components of the relationship than it is for our patients, or, you know, issues that arise from, you know, basically financially driven choices resulting in euthanasia. So they, you know, they kind of early on wanted to get us like thinking and, you know, considering those questions. And especially even just the impact it has on veterinarians and their mental health too, to be, you know, kind of handling those end of life decisions, you know, pretty often for most of us, I'd say.
So how do you handle as a vet a situation where, let's say, an owner wants you to do more than you think is right for the animal, or an owner wants to give up too soon on an animal? How do you, are those dilemmas, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, that is a frequent dilemma, and in a lot of cases, you know, I feel like for myself personally, I am constantly kind of trying to, you know, strike a balance between, you know, showing compassion for the human in that situation and advocating for my patients. You know, ultimately, I think what kind of gets me through it is that, you know, my job is to provide all of the possible information in a situation. But once I've done that, I can't make a final decision for someone. You know, I can educate from my, you know, from my knowledge, from my experience, from, you know, everything that, you know, that they're coming to me for. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I can't tell them what to do. You know, obviously if they ask me, what would you do? I have to think about that and be as honest as possible. But in some cases, yeah, it's one of those where like, man, I really wish, you know, they would have done more, or, you know, man, I really wish they would have, you know, withdrawn care sooner. But, you know, that's part of it.
Yeah, so it's different than in human medicine, because you're also advocate of the patient, but if there's a certain line that the parent, let's say, of a child crosses, you know, there's legal recourses, but
sure.
You can't do that. That's not true in veterinary medicine, I gather.
No, it gets really, really murky, just because, yeah, there, you know, there is to the point where, you know, if you genuinely feel like, you know, there is abuse or neglect or whatever the case may be present, you know, there are reporting agencies and avenues, but the intervention is not what you're going to see with, you know, obviously with humans and children, and that's, you know, for good reason. But from a legal standpoint, in most states, you know, animals, you know, they do have some protections and there are animal cruelty laws, but, you know, kind of defining what crosses that line is a little difficult, and, you know, animals are mostly still considered property, you know, in a lot of places.
Do you have personal beliefs regarding advanced animals like chimpanzees or dolphins or whales, animals we think are more cognitively advanced? Do you think there should be different kind of ethics for those animals?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really, you know, it's a hard question to answer, because, you know, personally, you know, obviously intelligence is something, you know, I think as humans we relate more to, and I think people are definitely prone to ascribing different levels of intelligence and a level of emotional intelligence to different species, but I think that's obviously going to be different for everyone as well. You know, you know, depending on what you most relate to or most bond with, you know, obviously there's some highly, highly intelligent, you know, bird species and things like that. But, you know, because we're mammals and they're not, I think a lot of people have a harder time, you know, relating to or connecting with birds maybe than they would to a dolphin or a chimpanzee. So I think it differs for everybody. You know, I emotionally connect more to dogs and cats than I maybe do to birds or reptiles, but I definitely respect people who, you know, have birds or reptiles as pets, but they think are more emotionally intelligent. But it does become a slippery slope as far as, okay, we, different protections for different species, then it's going to become a big argument of, who decides, what the higher order or more intelligent species are.
I've noticed among my fish that I have, there seem to be different intelligences, and I do interact with fish, which is really interesting to me, because that's a very foreign species, if you would, to a mammal, to mm-hmm. human. But they seem to recognize, and it's much more than a 3-second memory, which is what goldfish are supposed to have. I think that's probably not
right,
correct.
Which I think has been debunked anyway, but yes, I agree, because I've seen that even, we have fish as well. I like them. I think they're, really cool and fun to watch and look at. But even amongst our fish, there's definitely ones where I'm like, yeah, you just seem like you're more with it or know, recognize what's going on in your surroundings than maybe that one over there.
Yeah. So how did you decide you wanted to specialize in small animals as opposed to elephants?
Practically speaking, honestly, it was a bit of, the workload, the being able to work, close to home, not having to travel out to various, locations. Zoo animal medicine is highly competitive. So a lot of it was practical, and then just, loving dogs and cats.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating. This is it's a new world to me, the world of veterinary medicine. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about the psychology of animals and then the psychology of the people who interact with animals. So we'll be right back after these messages. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Anbar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Anbar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterpointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Thank you. Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, a special guest, Dr. Ariel Cooper, who is a veterinarian and is teaching us all about animals. And I would love to hear about the psychology of animals. Can you tell me, like, what's the difference between the psychology of a dog and a cat to start with?
Yeah, that is the question. So I think that, you know, obviously there's generalizations that go into this because you'll meet a vast array of both, just like people. I mean, obviously no two people have identical personalities, but I think the overarching generalizations would be, you know, dogs tend to be a little bit more, you know, outwardly affectionate, and, you know, a lot of dogs have a lot higher, you know, drive to do, you know, some kind of task, whether it's, you know, being a companion or, you know, whether it's as a working dog, whereas cats, I think, are a little more, you know, we're cats and we're happy to exist in the same space as you, but, you know, maybe not quite have the same level in a lot of senses as dogs are as far as showing excitement to see you.
And so again, different dog breeds have different kinds of, obviously, behaviors and also psychology, I assume?
Yeah, and I'd say a lot of that goes into the fact that, you know, we've been selectively breeding dogs for a long time, especially, you know, comparatively to cats. And, you know, dog breeds that are, you know, especially, you know, bred for a specific purpose, you know, that's played a major role. So, you know, you can kind of argue that, you know, human intervention or human interference has made a big difference in, you know, how we see dogs and how different dogs of different breeds behave, because you're going to have, you know, breeds that are, you know, were originally bred at least with, you know, with a job in mind, and, you know, compared to cats that are, you know, not as specifically bred for purpose.
And so dogs seem to be more attuned to humans as a generalization, I think, and seem to be very loyal. You think that's from the breeding?
I think a lot of it is breeding and just, you know, a longer, you know, dogs were, you know, one of the first species that humans domesticated, you know, and so dogs have been, you know, living next to and with humans for, you know, tens of thousands of years, that, you know, they're definitely that kind of bond and interaction has been felt and compounded upon. So I'd say that, you know, obviously you meet dogs that are maybe more aloof or, you know, less inclined to, you know, to human interaction. But, you know, the other thing of the psychology of it that goes the other way is that a lot of times dogs can be, you know, prone to, you know, being very, very highly sensitive to their humans' emotional states and, you know, things like that as well. So, you know, we do see what basically amounts to mental health issues in dogs and in cats, you know, probably in similar rates and things that we see it in humans.
So can dogs get anxious or depressed?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, we deal, anxiety is a very common, you know, probably the most common behavioral concern or complaint that I deal with, and it varies from, you know, things like situational, you know, dogs that are terrified of fireworks or thunderstorms or, you know, basically what we call noise phobias, dogs that have separation anxiety, and then dogs that just have kind of more generalized fears and anxieties. And we do see cats to some extent with that, but, you know, the dogs are the ones that I'm, you know, definitely being asked to consult on behavioral aspects quite a bit.
Do the dogs also develop psychosomatic symptoms? So an anxious dog can develop diarrhea and irritable bowel? Does that happen?
Yeah, that is actually a really common thing we deal with. Dogs, or at least, you know, what I was taught is that dogs have a very sensitive, what they call brain GI axis, meaning mental health stuff definitely can cause gastrointestinal symptoms, kind of like IBS. You know, one common diagnosis we see in dogs is something called stress colitis. So basically, you know, it's stress-induced, you know, inflammation in the colon that often causes diarrhea or other upset stomach symptoms, and that's actually really, really common in dogs.
Do you see the equivalent of broken heart syndrome in dogs? And humans, sometimes they die after their loved one dies. Is that present in dogs?
I don't know if I necessarily would see, you know, death, but I believe that dogs mourn, that dogs go through, you know, equivalent of a grieving process. You know, I have seen dogs that have been, you know, after their owners have passed away and they're, you know, in the hands of, you know, whoever next of kin is that takes over, or even after another, you know, canine in their household passes away. You know, I've experienced that with our dog Esmeralda, after her housemate Briar passed away. Definitely just, you know, there's a level of confusion and depression, that I think definitely dogs experience.
Now, let's move to horses. Tell me about how horse intelligence is manifested. I know you don't take care of those animals, but
no, that's okay.
One,
so,
three, six, right?
So horses are interesting because, you know, again, there are different, you know, arguments amongst different, you know, breed proponents and things like that about who, you know, the more intelligent horses are. But horses are interesting because, you know, they definitely, you know, kind of have to go through a, you know, bit of a domestication each time around. You know, horses aren't born ready to throw a saddle on their back and jump on their back. You know, with young horses, there's always kind of a slow, you know, breaking in process to get them to accept a saddle or accept a rider or, you know, be led. And so that's really interesting to me, kind of how it starts fresh with every baby horse. And, you know, there are some horses that are, you know, incredibly, incredibly intelligent. Some horses that are, you know, probably a little less so, and, you know, to the point where they may be dangerous to spend too much time trying to get up in their personal business. But I think, you know, horses are absolutely fascinating. I used to think I wanted to be an equine veterinarian. A lot of that why I didn't was because of the, you know, the demands of having to go out to farms and dealing with these over 1,000-pound creatures physically is demanding. But, yeah, horses are really interesting.
And then let's talk a little bit about rabbits. For many years, I thought, you know, rabbits are like rodents, you know, like guinea pigs. Mm. But since we got one into the home, I realized rabbits are quite different. What can you tell us about their psychology?
Yeah, I think rabbits are really interesting as well, because rabbits, you know, strangely, physiology standpoint with them, they actually share a lot in common with horses, oddly enough, physiologically or anatomically. But I think, you know, from a intelligence or even just like a, how they like to interact with humans, I'd say rabbits are a lot more like cats, or even, you know, some are more like dogs in that regard. I had a pet rabbit growing up, and she mostly kind of hung out in our backyard. We had an elaborate wooden decking system, so she had, you know, shade and cool. But you would go tap on the deck with a carrot, and she'd come out immediately. You know, she knew exactly, you know, how to get what she wanted. So I think rabbits are really fun pets as well.
And I like that they can be litter trained.
Yes, not just like a cat.
That's right. Well, this is so interesting. When we come back, I want to talk, please, about the psychology of pet owners.
Absolutely.
This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. with the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens, harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, a special guest, Dr. Ariel Cooper, a veterinarian, who's telling us about the psychology of animals, and I guess we people are animals too. Tell me about the psychology of pet owners. Why do people even want pets?
Yeah, that is a really great question, and I think, you know, it differs depending on, you know, the person. So, you know, again, they're most of the, you know, time what we see in my day-to-day practice is, you know, the pets are companions, and they're, you know, considered part of a family, family unit. So they're, you know, they're there for, you know, companionship, entertainment. There's definitely people who get pets for protection purposes. You know, I still see a fair number of people who have dogs that are hunting dogs, or, you know, obviously we see service dogs and dogs that are, you know, meant to do a specific task for their owner. So there's lots and lots of reasons that people get pets. And obviously it's not just limited to dogs and cats. You know, that's just my more common area of expertise, but you know, I think that overall, I would say the most common reason is for the companionship.
If you're considering a pet, what would you advise somebody? How does somebody know they're ready to have a pet in their home?
Yeah, I think that, you know, kind of thinking through, you know, what that day to day looks like, you know, kind of knowing what your routine is and knowing if, you know, because it's, you know, it's not a plant, it's not a, you know, thing that you can just kind of willy-nilly, you know, decide to, you know, leave for a weekend. You know, you kind of have to have an idea in mind, okay, does my lifestyle fit with the pet I'm thinking of getting, or vice versa, how do I get a pet that fits the lifestyle I want to continue to have? But just kind of knowing it's a responsibility as well. You know, it's not a right. You know, I get that a lot. You know, well, you know, it's my right to have it. It's kind of not. I mean, it's a living thing that you're, you know, taking into your care. So, I think just kind of being prepared that that's a commitment is one of the most important steps.
Now, some people want a particular pet or particular breed, and I know you and I have had some conversations about purebred animals and the difficulties they have, and maybe you can share some of those. What kind of, like, dog breeds might you want to avoid because of their genetic problems, for example?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things certain breeds are going to be more predisposed to, whether it's health-wise, whether it's behavior-wise. So, for example, I love golden retrievers. They're fantastic dogs. Most of the golden retrievers I've ever met are, you know, very intelligent, very loving. They make fantastic service dogs. They're highly trainable. But, you know, I personally would never own one because, you know, they are a breed that's highly, highly prone to certain types of cancers, including ones that can occur at a pretty young age. They oftentimes have a lot of, allergy-related or, you know, skin dermatological issues. For me personally, the amount of hair and the grooming required is kind of a turnoff as well. I think it's more than just thinking about like, I knew someone who had a golden retriever and it was really sweet, and so that's the kind of dog I want. There are definitely considerations. You know, there's even considerations of just, you know, okay, what climate do I live in, and is it, you know, fair or reasonable to, you know, have a dog that was maybe bred for an entirely different climate, you know, suddenly living, you know, where they're maybe not set up to succeed. And obviously accommodations can be made, but, I think that not everyone takes those factors into consideration. We see a lot of people who maybe get a dog that's, you know, not necessarily for beginners because the breed is, you know, has to have a task or a job to do, and they're very driven and they get bored easily and they get destructive when they're bored. And people don't realize that until suddenly they have this 10-month-old dog that just, you know, is ruining their lives, and they, you know, then they're looking at a situation of having to, you know, decide if they can keep this dog or not, and it's not really, you know, fair to the dog either.
You talked a little earlier about end-of-life issues, and I'm wondering, in terms of the psychology of the pet owner, when it comes to end-of-life, do you end up counseling pet owners sometimes, or what kind of issues come up?
Oh, absolutely. I more so than I ever thought that would be part of my day-to-day job. But a lot of times, you know, we're that point of contact, we're the person in the room that, you know, can kind of metaphorically hold their hand, or sometimes even physically hold their hand through, what's obviously a really rough time in that person's life. It comes down to, you know, it's a bond between veterinarian and pet owner, and sometimes I end up, you know, bonding, and they're people I've never met before, never seen, and probably won't ever see again in some situations. You learn about people, about their family, about, you know, a lot of people say like, I've had this pet since they were 5 weeks old and now they're 17. So it's an emotional journey for sure with every single one, whether I've known them for 10 years or I just met them 5 seconds ago.
Are there any roles for religious figures, like the priests or rabbis ever come and deal with losing animals, or that's beyond their purview?
You know, I don't know many that will. I've definitely have had, you know, people that have, you know, expressed, you know, religious, you know, inclinations, or, you know, I've had some people who have told me, you know, adamantly that in their set of religious beliefs, you know, they don't believe in euthanasia, and that's just not something that they're ever going to choose to do, and I have to respect that. My role is never to force someone into, you know, doing something they're not comfortable with. It's a little bit of that balance. But, I've definitely, I'm not sure I've ever had an actual, religious leader at the euthanasia itself, but I've had people tell me, like, yeah, you know, we had our, you know, did a blessing or that. I've definitely had people, you know, say prayers or things like that at some point during the process.
Do you have a stance on cremation versus burial? Do you talk about that, pet owners?
Yeah, I mean, from a logistical standpoint, cremation is the most common. A lot of places have restrictions about whether you're even allowed to bury animal bodies. You know, a lot of people don't own their property and various other things where they're not able to. So I'd say the vast, vast majority of what we deal with ends up with cremation. We have occasional ones that we'll take home for home burial. Something that's come to my attention recently that I am just absolutely fascinated with is it's kind of an alternative to traditional cremation, and it's called aquamation, where they manage to basically, you know, using hot water and, you know, and pressure and time, they kind of are able to take away the soft tissues. Preserving a lot more of the, you know, the skeletal structure and then just kind of gently, you know, grind it so you can still get remains back, but it's healthier for the environment. And so that absolutely fascinates me. I wonder if that's something we're going to move more towards over time.
Yeah. So it's there's obviously overlap between humans and animals, end of life some. But in some ways, it's interesting. Well, when we come back, we will have a few more final questions. I'm going to ask you what three tips you would give pet owners that they can best help their pets and maybe help themselves. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, a special guest, Dr. Ariel Cooper, a veterinarian. And before I'm going to ask you for your three tips, I do have a question about animal hospitals and especially animal emergency rooms, because I'm under the impression that many of them have been taken over by corporation, and I'm very sensitized to corporations taking over things, because this happens in human medicine as well, often to the detriment, in my opinion, to the human patients. Can you comment on that in terms of veterinary medicine?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. So there's an emergency veterinarian that's local to me. So it's one that, it's been a number of things in the, I've been in practice for 10 years. It's been around for much longer than that. But, in the 10 years since I started practicing near to this hospital, it originally was a, kind of privately owned, emergency animal hospital, sometime maybe 5 years from then it got purchased or bought out by a corporation. Interestingly enough, this corporation ended up having to sell it not long after due to they actually had monopoly issues in the area, and they were forced to dispose of that hospital. So they actually sold it to a different corporation. And so it's been interesting to kind of watch those changes happen, and speak with a friend of mine who's worked at that hospital through all of those different ownerships. It sounds like, that's a legitimate concern, but in some ways, it's also, the support of having kind of a corporate, backup to various issues and things like that. There are some benefits. There's definitely some detriments. I think the bigger thing, honestly, that really impacted emergency veterinary hospitals especially, but all of us, was the COVID pandemic. That drastically increased the number of pets that were being taken in for care, whether it was a lot of people acquiring pets, more people being home to recognize problems with their pets. But the demand for a while there absolutely surged, and it especially really affected the emergency vets, where they, first time I've ever seen them having to, actually say, like, we're not accepting any patients at this time, and diverting to other area hospitals, which, is one thing I just say to be like, triage is kind of the name of the game. So if you are at the emergency vet with your pet and you have to wait, consider yourself lucky that your pet is not in such a dire state that they're okay to wait.
I guess that's true of human emergency rooms too, I guess. That's interesting. So what three tips would you give pet owners or prospective pet owners that about taking care of their pets, or whether they should get a pet at all? What would you tell them?
I think the first one is kind of do some research. I don't think it's something to ever, I wouldn't consider a pet something to impulse buy, or impulse adopt either. So you're having that discussion with family, if you're a person as an individual, just kind of figure out what that looks like and realize, what kind of commitment you're making. Cause, dogs and cats these days especially can sometimes easily live 20 years, with a pet like a bird or a tortoise or something, that can be many decades. So kind of have a plan in place for that. My second tip would be, kind of once you're at that point, establish care with the veterinarian. It's going to be so much easier for us to help you if we have you kind of already, we have a baseline. We get to meet your pet when they're not super sick, just kind of get to know them and you. And start to build a relationship, to kind of build off of if and when, you need us. So as soon as possible, whether you just got your pet, you moved to a new location, just, even if you're not due for anything, even if your pet is healthy, just establish care, because it'll make your life a lot easier in the future. And then just, you know, my other tip, and this might be more of a self-serving tip, but, you know, realize that we all want the same thing, which is, you know, the best for you and your pet. But, you know, we're human too, and sometimes, you know, that means we, you know, the better option is for you to go to an emergency room or an urgent care, you know, because we know that we don't have the time or resources to help you in that moment and your pet needs help. So, you know, just kind of recognize, you know, the system that we have may not be perfect, but, you know, when we tell you you need to go seek emergency care, it's coming from a place of we really want your pet to get help.
So speaking of emergency care, can you teach us a little bit about pet insurance? Did you get health insurance for your pets, or how do you decide?
That is a really good question, and you know, the decision is, you know, it's a little bit individual for everybody. I think it's definitely at least looking into and knowing what exists. It's very different in the pet insurance realm than it is for most, you know, for most people having health insurance. There are different levels, but most of them work on what's more of a reimbursement. So you're going to pay out of pocket, and then hopefully your insurance will reimburse you, you know, a decent chunk of that minus whatever deductible you may have. But it may not be, you know, you need to kind of be able to cover that until you get reimbursed. And the other really big issue a lot of people run into is that pet insurances tend to have a lot of exclusions for pre-existing conditions. You know, they can be a real hassle to fight with. But, you know, whether it's pet insurance, whether it's having a fund set aside where you just put money into every month to plan for, you know, an eventual, you know, accident, illness, injury, but, you know, some kind of financial planning is so helpful, so that, you know, you're not sitting there realizing your pet needs a $5,000 estimate covered and it just completely took you by surprise.
Yeah. And another thought that I've been having is, so in our cultures, you know, dogs and cats are pets and rabbits are pets. In other cultures, people eat them. Does
mm-hmm.
that distribute all? How do you react to that?
I mean, it is interesting, and I try to have, obviously, you know, respect for other cultures, and, you know, realizing that, you know, my personal beliefs may not be everyone's, and you know, that goes the same probably for people who are vegan, you know, how they feel about other people who, you know, eat beef or chicken or, you know, what have you. So, you know, just like I wouldn't necessarily want a vegan person, you know, judging me for my decision to, you know, to eat beef sometimes, you know, I can't really judge too much on the people who, you know, that their culture is to eat. Horse meat is a delicacy in some countries and, you know, absolutely appalling in others. And I think it's just kind of an interesting world we live in that, you know, can differ so much.
Yeah. It's because each of us, I guess, have our own ethics. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
for me, you know, I respect life so much. It's hard. It's an interesting dilemma we each have to face. Well, Ari, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom with us. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did the same. And what was it that was Barb Barker used to say? Don't forget to spay and neuter your pets. We didn't talk about that, but we don't want unwanted
don't forget
population.
To spay and neuter your pets. I agree.
So on that note, we'll wish everyone an excellent week. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.